You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to the second edition of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, a podcast brought to you by me, Mega, and my co-author and a very good friend, Matt. How are you?
I'm fine. Still a bit tired. I've only had one coffee, but otherwise fine. How about you?
Okay. I have my coffee with me, so I'm not too bad.
Very good. So any funny noises on the podcast will probably be one of us gurgling his coffee.
Yeah. Well, it's been a month since the last edition. We're slapdash in the middle of September already. What have you seen in the last 30 days? Anything special, noteworthy, very bad, very good?
Yeah, I've actually just last night we went to see Lady Macbeth, which you have blogged about.
Oh yeah, how was that?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, enjoy is perhaps the wrong word. It is a very chilly movie, I find. I mean, it's there's few likable characters in it, and the one likable character is the one that the worst things happen to. But it's, I would say it's very well cast, extremely well acted, especially Florence Pugh, that's her name, right? She's very, very good. Mm-hmm, she is strong. And she also, actors sometimes have this thing where they want to be likable, and she doesn't go for that at all. I mean, she's intriguing. She's, I think, enticing, possibly even sexy, but she is not likable. And the longer the film goes on, the less likable she is. What I also thought was, I mean, you also wrote a blog post probably a couple of months ago about Sofia Coppola film,
The Beguiled.
Exactly, The Beguiled. Yeah. I think it makes for quite an interesting kind of companion piece to that one. It's also, I think, very much, I mean, set at a very similar time. It's also about women, women's roles, and women basically escaping their roles in an exceptional situation. And it also, in some ways, goes horribly, horribly wrong for the men. Not necessarily only for the men, but I think it's a very good film, definitely worth checking out. What about you? Have you seen anything good the last couple of weeks?
I've watched Jackie at Home. It's with Natalie Portman. It was released late last year, I think. I'd give it a qualified yes. It has some kind of framed narration in that after November 1963, there's a reporter visiting Jackie Kennedy, wants to have an interview. She refused all other requests, but him she accepted. He's played by Billy Crudup. He is slightly too curious, slightly too condescending. She tries to play cat and mouse with him, not in a flirty way, but in a way that seems to suggest you don't want to really know about me, you just want to know about JFK and how he died, don't you? Those scenes are written pretty well, I thought, although they're meandering. They're sort of interspersed throughout the movie. We always come back to that interview time and again because the rest of the movie is shown in back in flashback. I like the flashbacks more because, well, a president dies. It's almost always more interesting than a reporter interviewing someone. On the whole, I thought that the rhythm was sort of slightly off. There are scenes about the assassination and the aftermath, the burial, the convoy through the city, and it's always sort of interrupted by that by another interview bit. That sort of bothered me. I got into the mood and then I was yanked out of it again. Mm-hmm. I have also slight reservations about some of the casting, especially John Hurt. It must have been one of his last roles. He plays a priest. Jackie requests one. He gets, she gets John Hurt to talk to. And he's not fazed at all that she's JFK's widow. Not at all. And he meanders and he lets her talk and he doesn't have any answers. He could be anyone. He could be a stranger on a park bench, basically. And then he has one more scene where he tells her some kind of analogy that doesn't really fit the movie. I thought it was weird. Mm-hmm. And so John Hurt was sort of... I don't doubt the casting decision. It's more that it's that the role is sort of, what does it do with the movie? It doesn't really fit anywhere.
Okay, that is a shame. I mean, especially if it's one of John Hurt's last performances, it's a shame if the role doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it could be worse. I guess it could be Raul Julia in Street Fighter. But at the same time, you know, at least there you've got something that is alive, even if it's kind of wrong-headed and horrible.
That's true.
It's a shame to have John Hurt in a role that is kind of nothingy.
Mm-hmm. No, well, the casting decisions, the others are, they're okay. I think Peter Skarsgård, if that's his proper name, he's Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
John Carroll Lynch as, what's his name, Lyndon B. Johnson. And Billy Crudup as the reporter. And of course, Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
They're all fine, but it's the rhythm of the movie that didn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. It's almost experimental how they join scenes together.
Okay.
And I have to slightly criticize the director Pablo Larraín a little bit because Jackie Kennedy apparently was busy refurnishing the house when she got to be first lady. And they seem to have made some kind of documentary in black and white early television. And that seems to be something that really exists. And in the movie, that's replicated with Natalie Portman. And I think Larraín slightly ridicules Jackie Kennedy and maybe even Natalie Portman because his reshoot of those scenes don't do Natalie Portman or Jackie Kennedy any favors. It's sort of clumsy and you can see she's uncomfortable in front of the camera. She might have been coerced into doing that.
Okay.
And Larraín doesn't sanitize this. He probably goes even further than the real documentary. And that's sort of that's jarring, I thought. And because the movie is so experimental, we go back to the furnishing of the White House documentary time and again.
Yeah.
And it bothered me.
Okay, and I can see that. He's the one who also did No, right?
True, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I like that one, but I haven't seen any of his other films. I'll definitely check out Jackie at some point. But yeah, it was also the kind of film where it sounded like it could be intriguing, but it doesn't necessarily work all the time. So it's very much one where I thought I can wait till it's on TV.
Yeah, yeah. TV's fine. I'm glad I didn't go to the movies watching it on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, well, I'm interested in the director. He might be up to something very good with his next movie. We are set for a 3-hour romp through LA, aren't we, Matt?
Absolutely. I've recently rewatched Magnolia, and I have been wanting to rewatch it for a long time. It was my favorite film, absolutely my favorite film for a while. I kind of have that. I have my favorite films come and go in phases. Yeah. I think when I was probably in my late teens, early 20s, it was very much Seven, the David Fincher film. That was my favorite film. Possibly that says more about me as a late teen than I want to admit, but hey. After that, I would say it was Magnolia. As soon as I saw Magnolia, completely bowled me over. I saw it at the cinema, I think at least 3 times. Later on, it was kind of replaced first by Jules Jim, the Truffaut, and then later probably the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. But I would say that all of these films still have a very dear place in my heart, and Magnolia very definitely still has that place in my heart. It's when I rewatched it, I still enjoyed it a hell of a lot. It's a fantastic film. It's a unique film, I would say. It's also a confounding film, because what I found was that in some ways, I mean, basically, if you try to grasp it in terms of theme, it's actually pretty messy. I mean, it borders at times almost on the incoherent, or it should be incoherent. I mean, we briefly talked about this earlier this week over a cup of coffee. I find it fascinating. You basically watch the film, you start watching the film, and there are these three weird anecdotes, these three weird coincidences. You have the story of three Victorian times murderers, Greenberry Hill. You've got the story about the kid who basically tries to commit suicide, which fails but still succeeds. And you've got the story about a diver who's basically picked up by a, what do you call them, firefighting plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's basically the kind of stories where if you hear about and you think, yeah, that only happens in movies and in bad ones at that. So you watch those three sequences and you're prepared for a movie about weird coincidences, acts of God, and God probably in this case having smoked too much pot. And then you get the Amy Mann song at the beginning, One is the Loneliest Number. So you go from coincidences to loneliness, and you think, okay, so it could be coincidence, it could be loneliness. The film starts and it's not really about either of those. I mean, for the longest time, it develops a rhythm, a certain pace, it totally pulls you in, and you don't notice, you don't think about this. I think I thought about it because it was the first time I've seen the film in a long time, and of course, the way I watch films has changed since, you know, I was in my 20s. I think I was sitting there thinking, how do these things connect? Which I wouldn't have had done the first 3, 4, 5 times I saw the film. And my brain kept saying, they don't connect. And my heart kept saying, they absolutely connect. Shut up, brain.
Yeah, to me, at least on a very, very technical level, those three stories paved the way for any kind of license. You know, if you tell these three stories, you can tell as a fourth story whatever you want. Anything can happen. You are absolutely free of any convention, also of an overarching theme.
Mm-hmm.
So he just went ahead and told us another story.
Yeah, I mean, he told us so many stories. It's very much one of these episodic films where you've got, you know, a cast of billions, no, a cast of 20 or so, and they all have their little stories. And I do think, I mean, they connect after a while. They definitely connect in terms of you've got the connections between the different stories. People cross each other's paths. In that respect, I mean, it was compared at the time to Altman's Shortcuts, not just because of that, but also because of the, again, act of God and the capricious, not necessarily benevolent God, doing something really weird, which acts as a kind of caesura. It's like, okay, we're here. What does this mean? Where do we go from here? Yeah. They are similar films in some ways. I think, you know, you can absolutely see the comparison.
Yeah.
I think at the time, Anderson was even accused of being a bit of an Altman knockoff. At the same time, I think the rhythm of the film is completely different. It's more Scorsese than Altman in terms of its rhythm. But talking about this, and this is something that's actually just come to my mind now, I think even though intellectually, thematically, it's difficult to say this is what the film is about, I think it actually works almost as a piece of music, as a 3-hour symphony. You know, I think the ebbs and flows, the rhythms of the film, make it all work, make it all come together, aided, of course, by the fantastic score by John Bryan and by the songs by Amy Mann. I think in some ways it is a long, but definitely not long-winded symphony about, I mean, I said at the beginning, loneliness. And I think, you know, these people, they're surrounded by others, but they are lonely. Mm. Many of them are lonely. I think almost all of them, they're basically people who are not very good at life, most of them. Some of them more, some of them less, but most of them are, they're screw-ups to some extent. They're neurotics. They're not the kind of, you know, twee, laugh-at-me neurotics that you get in some of Woody Allen. They're more people who have basically tried to lead their lives, tried to be happy, but they don't quite manage. And that can be annoying as hell. I think there's films that do that, and the characters come across as needy. And I think most of the characters in Magnolia are needy in some way. They need something. I think William H. Macy's character, the gay, middle-aged quiz kid Donnie Smith, he's probably the neediest of them all. But they all want something. They can't quite grasp what it is they want. They're looking for it in the wrong places. I mean, to some extent, and this will sound tacky as hell, but to some extent, I think this is a film about people looking for love and not knowing how and not knowing where.
Yeah, I'll agree with that to a large extent. Although I don't think they're that neurotic. I mean, they are lonely. Even Phil Parma is sort of lonely. He wants to stay with people dying. He must be slightly desperate in his loneliness. But neurotic, I don't think he's very neurotic.
Mm-hmm. He's an oddball. He is definitely that, but I would agree.
He is.
I mean, at first, I think he comes across as, what the hell is this guy about? Also because Philip Seymour Hoffman, he doesn't make him nice. I mean, he's probably the nicest character in the film, but there is something a bit odd, a bit weird about... I think it's just Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's got this energy. He couldn't be basically a James Stewart character. There's something too weird about him. But that makes it work. That makes it work really well.
Yeah. With two other characters, it's hard to say whether they're neurotic because they're up to here with drugs. I mean, Linda Partridge and the Melora Walters character, they are constantly after either painkillers or cocaine or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say how they would lead their lives and if they weren't... drug addicts. Hard to say. It's really hard to say.
I mean, we see very few of these characters at their best. I mean, yes, you've got the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, Phil Palmer. He's not in pain other than basically through empathy. I mean, he's basically the nurse of a man who is dying, who could die any moment, who's looking for forgiveness. I guess that's another theme that comes in. I think a lot of these characters are looking for forgiveness. Sometimes not even for something that they have done. But I think a lot of them, they feel that they've done something wrong. They feel that they perhaps don't deserve love. I mean, to come back to that topic. And you've got the new quiz kid who his dad basically uses him as a performing puppet. And I think to some extent he feels that what's he doing wrong? You know, he tries his best, but his dad just uses him. You've got Melora Walters' character who was abused as a child by her dad, but she still seems to somehow blame herself or to feel that she doesn't deserve the attention and the love that the John C. Reilly character might give her. In that respect, I mean, they are sad characters, but they're not pathetic, not at all. There's a certain kind of grace in how the film brings them to a point where they say, where they perhaps are more okay with themselves. I find it difficult to talk about these themes without them sounding facile or tacky. I think, again, that's where the musical element comes in. In that sense, it makes sense like a symphony makes sense. You don't sit down after a symphony and say, oh, the themes of this symphony were this, and that. But it still is a unity, and I think this film definitely has that unity.
Yes, it does. Absolutely stunned me was that for all the, what do you want to call it, the sadness or the problems or the obstacles that all these characters have or the needs, it's still a sort of some kind of light film. Paul Thomas Anderson manages to keep all those balls up in the air like a very good juggler. And you can watch a very good juggler for very long. And that's why the movie is 3 hours long, but it seems much, much less. And I know I said the movie was sort of light. It's also heavy in other respects, but it's still sort of light, but still you can feel that it's rolling towards something, something decisive, something heavy.
Yeah. I mean, the lightness, I think, even though the themes in this film are really heavy, I mean, you've got abuse, you've got suicide, you've got drug abuse, you've got addiction. Few of these people are happy. But there's a lightness. I mean, it's also, I think, it's the kind of film that people who don't really like film might call pretentious because it does certain things that are, you know, not normally done in movies. I mean, hey, you've got a rain of frogs at some point. But the thing is, I don't think it is pretentious at all. It has a certain lightness about that. And it also, it has a sensitivity to what is ridiculous. Not in a bad way, but basically all of these people there, just like we are, they're kind of slightly ridiculous at times. In their sadness, in their being lost, it doesn't laugh at them, but it looks at them and it also kind of tells them, just look at yourself, take a breather, and also perhaps laugh at yourself a bit. I think, you know, you've got that with the rain of frogs. It's not biblical. Yes, it is also biblical, but mostly it's actually kind of funny. You know, suddenly you've got frogs falling down. They could have actually made it funny. I think at some point they wanted to have Amy Mann singing It's Not Easy Being Green as the frogs fall from the skies. They didn't do that. I think that's a good decision because it is a fine balance. But, I mean, you've got characters like John C. Reilly, and there is something funny about him. You've got William H. Macy's Donnie Smith. And as I said, you know, there's something sad about him, but there's also something just a bit funny about him. I think William H. Macy always has this thing where he's just slightly a cartoon figure, yet still deeply human.
Yeah.
And it works. I mean, you have moments where you laugh, where you think, this is actually kind of funny. It's not ha-ha funny. I mean, the film doesn't tell us jokes, but it basically tells us the world does weird things. The world does stupid, ridiculous things. Does that mean the world has some kind of nihilistic lack of meaning? No, absolutely not. But every now and then you should also kind of have your antennas up for the ridiculous and laugh at the situation when you can. And they're shitty situations, some of those. People are dying, people are suffering.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes frogs fall from the sky and you stop and take note and you think, huh, okay.
Yeah. No, I agree. There is a lot of fun in the movie. It could be downtrodden. It could be, you know, making its point much too hard. It doesn't. I mean, Quiz Kid Donnie Smith needing braces. He doesn't need braces. He wants them because he's in love with another man who has braces.
Exactly.
Or the police officer, the John C. Reilly role of Officer Jim Curring, telling a young kid, be cool, stay in school. I mean, you can even almost hear the kid rolling his eyes because the young boy just sang a rap song to the police officer. And then the police officer, all he can retaliate is be cool, stay in school. He's lucky it even rhymes. So moments like this are very, very funny, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And especially because of the actors. I think, you know, if you read it, you'd probably think, I'm not sure this is going to work. But the combination of PTA's directing and the actors, and I have to say, I think many of the actors in this film, I only started to become aware of them really because of Anderson. I mean, it was basically first Boogie Nights, which shares so many actors, and then this one. Mm-hmm. Philip Seymour Hoffman, especially, I mean, I think I first saw him in The Coen Brothers, The Big Lebowski, and there he didn't leave that much of an impression. But then when I saw him first in Boogie Nights and then this, it was basically a double whammy of, wow, this guy is good. Yeah. I mean, when I watched it, it still hurts that this guy is gone. Because he was definitely one of the greats.
Does.
And then you've got John C. Reilly, who is also fantastic, who also has this kind of, always this fine balance of being funny, being pathetic, being likable, but not being, you know, kind of twee. You've got Julianne Moore, who I also basically, I mean, again, we've got this connection from The Big Lebowski to Boogie Nights to this. And of course, she is amazing. She's just such a raw nerve of an actress in these parts, and she does it so well. It's a shame I haven't seen her in anything at that level for a while now, which is a real shame because she's just, I think she's probably done her best work in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I hope that she will get more material like that again.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, William H. Macy, I think I fell in love with him as an actor in Fargo, and what he then does in this one, what he did in Boogie Nights, these people just worked so well with Anderson. I think I still kind of regret that Anderson changed his style and his approach quite drastically. I mean, next after Magnolia, you had Punch Drunk Love, a film that I find fascinating, but I still don't quite understand. And then comes the Anderson of There Will Be Blood and The Master, and they're fascinating films, but they are completely different. I find it almost impossible to reconcile in my head the director who did Magnolia and the director who did The Master. A film that is much more chilling, much more cold, much more Kubrickian, basically. And it's almost as if the guy had a stroke and had to learn directing anew. And what he does is still amazing, but it's a completely different kind of amazing. And I kind of miss the warmth of Magnolia era Anderson.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think Anderson is horrified about making the same movie twice, even tone-wise or theme-wise. I mean, after Boogie Nights, he locked himself up in William H. Macy's Vermont Cabin and wrote Magnolia in a complete frenzy because he saw snakes slither by the hut he stayed in all the time, wrote Magnolia. And he went there in order to write a completely different movie because he didn't want to be remembered as the guy who did Boogie Nights. Mm-hmm. Ironically, he's now remembered because he's the guy who made Magnolia after Boogie Nights or something like that. So, I think with everything he does, he picks up something new. There is a point in saying that Boogie Nights and Magnolia have some similarities, not the least some of the cast.
Mm.
But otherwise, they're also really rather different.
I mean, I definitely agree thematically, story-wise, but I think in terms of feel, which is, of course, one of those utterly vague categories, but to me, Boogie Nights and Magnolia feel very similar. To me, at The Master and There Will Be Blood feel very similar. As I said, you know, I think to some extent, Boogie Nights and Magnolia, they both have this Altman and Scorsese meet at a bar. They really hit it off. And then 9 months later, you've got Boogie Nights and Magnolia, yeah. Which is completely unique, yet kind of, you know, resonates with those two other directors. And I've used the word Kubrickian, you know, talk about pretentious, I guess, you know. I definitely think that There Will Be Blood and The Master have that. There's this chilling quality. It's also there in the music. I mean, I think music very much defines the tone of a movie. And I don't remember exactly, did John Bryan also do the music for Boogie Nights?
I remember a lot of pop music in Boogie Nights, and some of the score might be by John Bryan, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's also the I mean, as you said, the actors, the kind of work that the actors do, even if the characters are different. For me, they resonate. Those two films resonate, and the two later films resonate. But in between them, I really can't say. It doesn't even feel like a development. It just feels like a complete change. I mean, there I definitely see it, that after Magnolia, he might have said, I do not want to do that anymore. So next I'm going to do a film, basically a weird romantic comedy with Adam Sandler and lots of pudding. And then I'll do There Will Be Blood. I mean, there, yeah, it's definitely a hard reset that he did. I think the main reason why I absolutely respect that, and I think the films he's done since are fascinating, and some of them are fantastic films. I think The Master is a masterpiece. I'm not sure I like it, but I definitely respect the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I do miss is, as I said, the warmth. I think, again, we talked about this briefly last week over that cup of coffee. Magnolia is very much about evoking empathy in the audience. I mean, that, again, sounds a bit trite and touristic, but I know few films that do it as much as Magnolia. If you sit there and you either judge these characters or you laugh at the characters first and foremost, you're not going to get much out of Magnolia. You're not going to sit there for 3 hours and laugh at characters in pain. Even if the film lets you also laugh at them, and the film lets them laugh at themselves to some extent, but you have to empathize. And I think probably, again, as I said, you know, my favorite films come in phases. Same to some extent with TV series, and I think Magnolia very much prepared me then for some of the HBO series like 6 Feet Under, which were also about people in Southern California being kind of a bit fucked up, not quite knowing how to live, being messes, being, some of them at least, neurotic. And that series too, I mean, 6 Feet Under was very much one of my favorite series. It is still one of my favorite series, but back then it was the favorite series I had. And I think it very much shares this with Magnolia, that it's about not laughing at people, not judging people, but empathizing. Not necessarily agreeing with what they do. Sometimes you can sit there and think, bloody hell, woman, bloody hell, man, why are you doing that? This is the worst thing you can do right now. But you want them to succeed. You want them to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, perhaps that sounds a bit sentimental, but I don't think that either 6 Feet Under or Magnolia are sentimental in that respect. There is sentiment. As I said at the beginning, you know, I think the film makes perfect sense emotionally, and I think that's how it wants to work. It's not a dumb film. It's not sentimentally dumb. It definitely has a brain and everything. But it primarily works through emotion. It wants you to feel for these people.
Yeah.
It wants you to understand where they're coming from to some extent. And I think it succeeds extremely well at that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is something that you then totally don't have in The Master or in There Will Be Blood. I think the characters in those films, to some extent, you will not be able to understand them fully. You don't understand. Mm-hmm. You see that there's rage. You see that there's anger. You see that there's fear. You see that there's, you know, this is someone who will basically beat someone to death because he doesn't like him, but he can't fully understand that. There's, you're almost like clinically looking at these people who, in some way, are actually psychopaths.
Yeah, at that moment they have some psychopathic traits. Yeah, I agree. But I think they're all in denial. No, I'm not lonely. No, I'm not going to die. No, no, I can handle my drug problem. I mean, they're depicted in such an intense way that you sort of see that you wait for them to come around in a way. Mm-hmm. Maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Yeah.
And that's, I think some of them are going to sort of make it.
Mm-hmm.
And others will be completely destroyed. And you wait, you sort of look at them in amazement and you wait for them to realize what's up for them.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to them.
Yeah, in Magnolia, definitely. I mean, in Magnolia, I basically wanted all of these people to find forgiveness.
Yeah.
Even Jimmy Gator, who probably, you know, the film decides at some point, this man is not going to be forgiven. He abused his daughter, most likely. I mean, I think basically, even though it's never spoken out loud, exactly, yes, this did happen. Except in a picture, I think there's a picture somewhere where you've got this caption in it which says, and this did happen, but this did happen, which might refer to that. So, you know, of course he did something horrible, but the film up to that point, I think, suggests that everyone might gain some tiny little degree of redemption or forgiveness. Mm. And he's the one where the film says, no, he's not going to be forgiven. What he has done is irredeemable.
Yeah.
And I understand it, but it feels weird coming after so much empathy. It feels weird that a film that basically asks you to empathize with pretty much everyone suddenly says, this man is not worthy of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to The Master and to There Will Be Blood. And I think those characters I have no empathy for. I also don't think the film wants us to feel empathy for them. These people are enigmas. And in some ways, they're almost not quite human. Whereas in Boogie Nights and Magnolia, they are so deeply human.
Yeah, they are. They live in a sort of artificial... I mean, I think LA is artificial. I know it exists, but it's sort of... There's a lot of surface and not much depth, at least if you ask people who've been there who don't want to live there. It's strange that he chose LA to sort of show us people who are so easy to grasp and to empathize with and to be with for 3 hours. I don't know. It is his backyard. He says it was really nice to go home from work every evening and sleep at home and then go back to work in the morning. He lives around there. He lives around Magnolia or thereabouts, Anderson. So he knew the neighborhood well, and he could use its atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the movie is almost chronological, isn't it? It's there's not much time shift, nowhere.
Exactly.
And he knows that area, and he knows the people, and he completely empathizes. And I think you're right. Yeah, the latter movies show us people who are not sympathetic. You wouldn't want to be in the same room with them. You can't figure them out, some of them. You don't want to be them. You don't want to be with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Master, either you are completely enticed with him or you abhor him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can take a neutral stance towards that character, the Master.
Mm-hmm.
And in Magnolia, you have people who are... You find yourself easily in them, even if they're almost way out of what your life is. I mean, I've never been to a seminar for seducing women. I've never taken hard drugs. I've never crashed in an ambulance. I've never been in a quiz show. So somehow he manages to get you with every single character, or with most characters, and that's a really an achievement. And if he would have done it on an intellectual way, he wouldn't have achieved what he achieved with using those outrageously invented or unlikely stories.
Mm-hmm.
It might well be some kind of modern version of fairy tales, you know, to regale us and to sort of bring us even even some kind of moral story without wagging a finger. You know, this is what life is like, at least in LA for some people. No, it isn't, but it's really interesting to look at them. It's fascinating. You're taken in for 3 hours. Whenever I watched Magnolia, I've seen it at the movies, I think, twice or three times, and just as many times on DVD. I was gone. I was in there, and I only came out when the credits rolled. And that rarely happens with a movie, yeah. with me.
No, I think that probably my reaction that told, you know, is this actually coherent? My brain basically going, ho, ho, ho. I think partly that's also because I rewatched it on TV. And I think at the cinema, my brain wouldn't have had a chance. At the cinema, my brain would have just been told, you shut up now for 3 hours. You can still think, but you don't have to talk the whole time.
Yeah.
I realize that there's one character and one actor we haven't talked about, and I don't want to finish this podcast without quickly addressing him. I mean, I said that there's lots of actors that I first started really noticing around this time, but of course there's an actor who's been with us since the 80s, and I was extremely surprised by his part and by his dedication to that part in Magnolia, and that is Frank T.J. Mackey, played by Tom Cruise. I mean, he's done weird stuff after that. I'm thinking, yeah, for instance, of Tropic Thunder. Mm-hmm. But Frank T.J. Mackey, I think, is an exception. I think Tom Cruise largely plays parts where he runs and he smiles and he's the hero.
Yeah.
And Frank T.J. Mackey, I think, if you don't hate him 10 seconds into his first appearance, I'm not sure I want to be friends with you. I mean, he is basically one of those pickup artist pieces of misogynist trash, and he embraces it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could almost think that he's the villain of the piece. The film doesn't have a villain of the piece, but Frank T.J. Mackey is horrible. You don't want to spend any time in a room with him, even if you're a sad man who can't get any women.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that admirable. I don't think he's done anything since that is even close. I mean, of course, he played a bad guy in Collateral. But in a way, Collateral, that was just a slight sidestep from his usual parts. It was a very good part. I think he did very well in Collateral. But basically, he played the bad guy version of his usual heroes.
Yeah.
And in Tropic Thunder, he played an utter caricature under lots of makeup. He was very funny. He was very good. But it's still different. I think there's a vulnerability in Tom Cruise's performance in Magnolia that we've not seen before or since.
Yeah. He made Mission Impossible 2 at the same time. And in some scenes, especially when he parades in front of the female reporter with his pants down, you can almost see the adrenaline coming off him. You know, he went through numerous workouts for Mission Impossible 2, and of course you can see that also in his Frank T.J. Mackey. He's full of testosterone in some scenes. You barely can stop him. He talks about I'm a Stinger missile. He almost starts rapping in that scene. He's full of it. He's very, very extroverted, bordering on aggressive.
Mm-hmm. And he's probably stolen a prop of the Boogie Nights set.
We all know
which one it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Standout performance.
In much more than one sense, yeah. I have a secret theory. I think the Frank T.J. Mackey role is still the reason that Nicole Kidman packed her suitcases and left. I might be wrong, but I still don't think he fully grasped what he did, Tom Cruise, in that movie. His agent probably told him, no, don't do this. If you do this, your name is no good anymore in Hollywood. You're dead in the water. Don't do it. And he probably said, oh, well, I have to do something. You know, I don't want to come out the hero. I don't want to come out on top every time. I have to do to counterpoint it. And along came Magnolia, and then he did it. I'm convinced that he hasn't fully understood what he did in that movie. It's a fantastic performance, and I really doubt that there is another actor who could have pulled it off. It's sort of, I admire him for that in a way. Tom Cruise movies are rarely my favorites, but in there he sort of he succeeds completely, I think.
Yeah. No, I think after that, he can make any number of the Mummy movies, and all is forgiven, Tom.
Yeah, I think so. No, I sort of... It's his 15 minutes of fame, or his 3 hours of fame, of real movie-making success, you know. Fame, he's got that up to the hilt. But in there, he's really good. You can compare it to Punch Drunk Love. I mean, Anderson saw something in Adam Sandler that no one else did. No one. He took Adam Sandler and made him, well, act, you know. I've never seen Adam Sandler act in any other movie. I haven't seen many of them. But Punch Drunk Love works thanks to him, largely. And Anderson has a gift in seeing that in people. Maybe he saw something in Tom Cruise. Maybe Tom Cruise was forced upon him. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible that Anderson thought, that's a Tom Cruise role. The guy from Top Gun. He can play a horrible misogynist. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, of course, we have seen him in a wheelchair screaming penis at the top of his voice. But it was more like, you know, this is what people think Oscar-winning, Academy Award-winning acting looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like it was a role of subtlety. I think Frank T.J. Mackey, even though the character isn't subtle, the performance is.
Mm-hmm. I think he... If Tom Cruise can make himself disappear in a role, it's an absolute success. And I think Frank T.J. Mackey... I forget that I'm watching Tom Cruise at some point.
We don't want this podcast to become 3 hours long like the film it talks about. I think we cannot we cannot compete with Magnolia as a film. But yeah, it might not be the film that feels like my favorite movie right now, but it's one of the films that will always be closest to my heart, and for very good reason. I think it's a shame that people don't talk about it all that much anymore, because they're in love with the... I think especially the P.T. Anderson who did The Master, who's a very different Anderson. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Magnolia, anyone listening to this who hasn't seen it yet, you might not like it, you might hate it, but you should at the very least watch it, because there's very few films around like that.
True. You went to see it at the movies the third time, and there was me and one other person. Can you imagine that? It proves Roger Ebert's law of a good movie. No good movie is for everyone.
Absolutely. And I very much hope that when you left the cinema, it rained frogs.
It probably rained, but not frogs. I got spared, so... I really like talking about it. It's always difficult. It's also one of my favorite movies. Sometimes it is my absolutely favorite movie, but it shifts. Sometimes I'm in that mood, sometimes I'm in another mood. I'm not the kind of person that has an all-time favorite number one movie. I think that's slightly too one-dimensional. It's definitely up there in my top three. And it's always difficult to talk about favorite movies in a way that does the movie any kind of justice. But the last 45 minutes or so have been very great fun. Thanks a lot, Matt, for talking about Magnolia.
No problem. Thank you.
Sure. Anytime. This was the second installment of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. My coffee cup is empty. There are other people queuing up for that coffee table. We will be back in a month's time. We thank you very much for listening, and have a very great month of very great movies and TV series and books and theaters and whatever kind of culture you're interested in. Thanks a lot and goodbye.
Bye.